This is The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano.
They're running a strange program, y'all.
Now, here's Frank Morano.
There is one issue that affects everybody, whether you are young, old, male, female, non-binary, Republican, Democrat, non-political, black, white, Haitian, whatever the case may be. There is one issue that not only affects every person listening to us right now, but it affects issues related to the environment, affects issues related to national security, the economy, and just about everything else. It's also an issue that everybody seems to have an opinion about. The issue is energy. I was at a bachelor party over the weekend, and a friend of mine who's an electrician said he's very anti-electric cars, even though he's an electrician. And he says anybody that gets an electric car is stealing from the electric grid. And he proceeds to go on literally a 12-minute diatribe about how electricity is not meant to power things that are 2,000 pounds. And I'm not saying whether he's right or wrong, but the point is, everybody is passionate about it. And it seems like where we are in society today is some people want energy that's clean. That's why things like wind and solar have gotten so much attention. Other people want energy that is cheap. Other folks want energy that is reliable and that will make sure that your car doesn't shut down when you're halfway through a road trip, or that your lights don't go out when there's a precarious weather situation. Is it possible that there is an energy out there that is clean, efficient, reliable, and inexpensive? For years, people have been touting the possibility of nuclear energy. Now, when we think of nuclear energy, we think of power plants that can power wide swaths of land. But imagine if your car was powered by nuclear energy. Does that sound like science fiction? Well, it just so happens there is a company that is planning to lead a rollout of small nuclear reactors. And one of the people behind that is someone we know quite well, and in the interest of full disclosure, is not only the owner of this radio network, but a close friend and the man single-handedly responsible for me being able to pay my mortgage. I want to first welcome John Catsimatidis, who is the owner of the Red Apple Group, the host of the nationally syndicated show The Cats Roundtable, and the author of the best-selling book, How Far Do You Want to Go? Lessons from a Common Sense Billionaire. John, thanks for staying up late or getting up early, whichever it is.
Well, good morning, Frank. I'll tell you, the truth is I took a little bit of a nap, and I set the alarm clock, and I woke up about 15, 20 minutes ago, so I feel fresh. Now, your friend was a little bit wrong about the 2,000 pounds. The average electric car probably weighs 6,000 pounds, and that was the because of the weight of the battery. And that was the reason that that garage collapsed when there were too many electric cars on the roof, and it had a weak structure. And it's going to be a further problem if you have too many electric cars in our bridges.
Well, I have
somebody out there better think about that.
I have a lot of questions about what you're doing and about electric cars and a whole bunch of things. But let me bring on two other members of our panel who are going to help us explain this to folks and work our way through this. I want to welcome Bob Percopo, who has had a distinguished career in business, including playing pivotal roles at companies like AIG. Now he is the COO of the United Nuclear Group. Bob, welcome to the program. Thanks for staying up late with us.
Thank you, Frank.
And let's also welcome someone that's someone that folks who listen to these radio stations are very familiar with, Jay Nelson Happy, the attorney for the Red Apple Group and one of the brightest legal minds anywhere. Nelson, it's great to talk to you again.
Hey, thank you, Frank.
Okay, so let's begin, John, with your interest in this. I think most of the audience probably knows that you have a history in real estate. You have a history in the oil business. You have a long history in energy. Why, after such a lengthy career in the oil business, would you decide to explore nuclear energy? What brought you to this point?
Frank, this is the energy of the future. There is nothing else that could replace fossil fuels or oil over the next 50 years. Oil is going to be around forever. Well, forever as far as what we're living with. I would say next 100 years. But nuclear energy is the only thing that's powerful enough to be able to run this country. Anybody that thinks that windmills and solar cells are going to run this country, well, they're a little bit light-minded, a little lightness in the head. And everybody that really believes this, then my joke was I'll sell them the Brooklyn Bridge. And I'll give them a good price on the Brooklyn Bridge. We'll make a deal with Eric Adams and Curtis Sliwa.
Yeah, I think with congestion pricing, you might get some takers for that. Bob, before we get to what you guys are doing, I'm wondering if, and Nelson as well, I'm wondering if you guys can educate our audience a little bit about nuclear energy in general. One of the things that people that push nuclear energy always say is that there are no greenhouse gas emissions and that it's actually a much cleaner way to provide energy than things like fossil fuels. What do you think about nuclear energy, and if people are concerned about the carbon footprint or fossil fuels and global warming, is nuclear energy a way to turn the tide in that respect, Bob?
Okay. It certainly is, and it's really not new. Our Navy has been running ships, and they're a lot more than 2,000 pounds. They push aircraft carriers at over 40 knots. They provide electricity for over 5,000 crew. They provide steam to heat the carriers, and they provide steam to launch aircraft and the catapults. So it's there. It is greenhouse gas free. The best part about nuclear power is, as we're trying to phase out of coal, which, by the way, we're phasing out of, but the rest of the world is growing in it, especially Southeast Asia. Australia and New Zealand are making a ton of money on both natural gas and on coal sales into the region. But when you look at nuclear power, it's replacing the baseload capacity that we're losing by taking coal out of the equation. People just don't want to understand that there are different components of the energy dispatch curve. There's baseload capacity, which historically has been nuclear, coal, hydropower. Unfortunately, in the developed world, hydropower has been fully developed. You can tweak the turbines a little, and you can get a little bit more out of it. We've got Native Americans and First Nations in Canada that want all the dams and the turbines removed from the rivers because it's interfering with their fishing. If you really want a history with wind and solar, and it has a role to play, but not a big role, you need natural gas. The environmentalists first wanted to kill coal, and now they're saying when we finish killing coal, we're going to kill natural gas. You physically cannot have wind and solar without natural gas. So people need, and I've made this pitch because I've advised the Senate Energy Committee and the House Energy Committee periodically. And I said, before Congress votes on anything in the energy space, they need to bring somebody in and educate the Congress on what energy really is about, because they don't understand it. Nuclear is the way to go. So we talked about the nuclear Navy. There was a big rush in the United States to build nuclear power plants, but the emphasis was always to build 1,000 megawatt reactors, 1,500 megawatt reactors. The problem there is they're usually building for a future, maybe 5, 10, or 15 years out. And if that load never materialized, or while you were trying to grow to that level, you had dead electrons that you couldn't do anything with. And I think the small modular reactors are going to change that curve.
Okay, so this is what's exciting, and this is why this is news. And people may have seen the headline in the New York Post or in Fox Business. And if time permits, by the way, we'll try and take a few calls, 800-848-9222, that there's going to be a rollout of small nuclear reactors, which, while nuclear technology may not be new, this type of nuclear technology is new, at least for a consumer basis. I've never gone into a car dealership and had been offered a nuclear-powered car. Let me ask you, fellas.
Well, it's not really a nuclear-powered car. This is These are the same nuclear reactors that power our submarines. So you know our submarines, how wide are they? They're not that big. So these are small nuclear reactors that will power a city of 250,000 people, a city of 500,000 people, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it powers a city. It powers data centers. It powers anything that needs and the lifespan of some of these reactors are, I don't know, Bob would know better than me, anywhere from 40 to 67 years, I've heard.
So, Bob and John, you both have made the comparison to our nuclear-powered naval vessels. What are there any specific advancements or innovations that differentiate these small modular reactors from traditional nuclear reactors?
Size and cost.
Size and cost.
Those are the two big factors. If I need 40,000 megawatts, I take a 40,000 megawatt module, I put it in place. If my load grows and I need another 20,000 megawatts, I bring a 20,000 megawatt unit in. So you're building for current demand, not expected future demand. And then as that demand grows, you're playing catch up, and it's a factory built unit. You're not subject to the vagaries of on-site construction, weather delays. They're made inside a factory, brought on a plant, connected to the grid, and you're up and running.
Nelson, let me ask you a question as the lawyer here, and maybe this should be the most obvious, because a lot of times the efforts to build a nuclear power plant are totally stymied. It's one of the reasons we haven't seen a new nuclear power plant built in the United States in some time. The efforts to shut down a nuclear power plant are often become a regulatory morass, as we're seeing now with Indian Point in New York. Given the complexity and the regulatory hurdles associated with nuclear energy products, and nuclear energy projects, what strategies does Red Apple have in place to navigate those sort of challenges?
Well, that's really a great question, because the regulatory environment is a tough one. The NRC is responsible for regulating the small modular reactors, just like it is big power plants. So we have to overcome a problem in the environmental community. Just as the environmental community is opposed to gas-powered plants or coal-powered plants, they're also opposed to nuclear-powered plants because of the accidents that happened at Three Mile Island and Chernobyl a long time ago. So we face a regulatory environment that's basically hostile to nuclear plants. President Biden has recently suggested that there should be more liberalization of licensing of nuclear power plants, because I think even the Biden administration recognizes the need for this form of nuclear energy. But as John pointed out, the history of this type of energy, it does relate to the nuclear submarine. And in the former Soviet Union, the country took the old nuclear reactors that were inside their submarines, parked submarines in inlets all over the Soviet Union, and are using them even today to power cities there. So they've proven to be completely safe, but the old submarines are starting to rust. So the risk is not with the power plant. The problem is just how to keep these submarines afloat. In the United States, with small modular reactors, we need an environment that will give permission to build these plants. They're actually built in factories instead of stick built like houses are. And right now, one company has achieved approval by the NRC to build these plants. And even though that company doesn't appear to be viable financially right now, the fact that they have gotten permission is an indication that this form of nuclear reactor will, in fact, be approved. But we have to live down the environment that was created from a public relations standpoint by right. the Three Mile Island accident, which was it's hard to believe, but that was 45 years ago.
So,
and no one ever got sick or was hurt by, I guess, the worst nuclear reactor it's ever been in the United States accident. So it didn't turn out to be anything.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that. I'm also glad you mentioned President Biden, because one of the things that I wanted to emphasize is this is a totally nonpartisan issue, right? Right. In an era where it seems like certain technologies are pushed by left wing entities and certain technologies are pushed by right wing entities, this is not a Democrat or Republican thing. This is for anybody that wants efficient, clean and reliable energy, right?
No, that's absolutely true. And yet, I was just channel surfing and Netflix and noticed a Three Mile Island special, which I thought, this is interesting. This must be an historic event. But I found out there's a it's a brand new anti-nuclear show on television that's being produced today, which suggests to me that there is an anti-nuclear group that is quite strong and using fear tactics in order to diminish or make more difficult advancing our energy future with nuclear energy. So it'd be interesting to know who has a financial stake in stopping nuclear.
All right. Nelson, Bob, and John, I'm not sure which of the three of you is the best person to answer this question, but obviously, even if it was 45 years ago, people remember Three Mile Island. They remember Chernobyl. They remember Fukushima in Japan. How does United Nuclear Group plan to address public concerns about nuclear safety and waste management with this SMR initiative?
I think the biggest thing that we can do is use the nuclear Navy and its safety record, which is over 60 years old, and it's exemplary. What happened in Three Mile Island, there was a human error. The automated system shut Three Mile Island down, and as Nelson said, there was no radioactive release that was damaging to anybody. If you look at Chernobyl, Chernobyl was Soviet technology. What they did is they didn't believe in containment. If you've ever been in a nuclear plant, or if you've ever looked at plans for a nuclear plant, the rebar and cement is built to withstand a jetliner fully fueled crashing into it. Russians didn't do that. When Chernobyl blew, there was nothing to contain the radioactivity, and it caused the disaster. Fukushima was another. The Japanese built the containment pools at 3 meters above sea level in an active tsunami and seismic area. When the earthquake happened, the tsunami that was generated was 9 meters. The reason for the spent fuel pools being at a low level, it made it real easy to offload the spent fuels, send them to France, have them reprocessed, bring them back, and load them back into the plant. When Fukushima blew, the Japanese government was blaming the utility was blaming the government. Nobody brought in, well, once the power lines went down, it went to the first level of backup, which was diesel. They brought no diesel engines in, incremental diesel engines in, brought no incremental fuel in. That kicked them over to the next backup. which was battery backup. They never brought new batteries in to continue to keep the spent fuels pools cool. So, you know, you had three different instances, one which was benign, and that was Three Mile Island. You had one that was a technology issue and just building methodology for Chernobyl. And then you had Japanese hubris, which created a major problem in Fukushima. I was involved primarily in Fukushima. When Fukushima blew, we had 25,000 people in Japan when I was at AIG. And I was tasked with running the crisis management group to figure out how to protect our people. So, yeah, if you look at what, you know, you raised the issue, Frank, that it really isn't a partisan issue. Let me explain. The first issue that really created a problem, and if you talk to anybody in the nuclear industry, any of the nuclear utilities, they'll tell you the biggest single thing that hurt nuclear power was the China syndrome with Jane Fonda. That scared the pants off of virtually everybody. When you move beyond things like that, you look at what happened when Obama was running for president. Harry Reid said, I will support you, but what you need to do is you have to guarantee me you will kill Yucca Mountain. And Yucca Mountain was designed to be the repository for spent fuels. And I was at the DOE with the group that was seconded by IBM, from IBM to the DOE, and they were told by the White House, kill Yucca Mountain. We need you to write a study that says that the containment capacity of Yucca Mountain can't handle current fuel, spent fuel rods, let alone future fuel rods. That was flat out wrong. If anytime you look at anything that talks about spent fuels or nuclear fuels in general, they always talk about weight. They don't talk about volume. If you took all the spent fuel, and this is a statistic from Entergy, from the CEO of Entergy, if you took all the spent fuel rods, and we don't reprocess, how do we reprocess? Well, if you take the spent fuel rods, the containment would be one football field, one U.S. football field, 16 feet deep. If you reprocess, like many countries do, the U.K., France, and Japan, and if you reprocess those fuels, it would be one end zone, 9 feet deep. Yucca Mountain was a huge cavernous space. But the deal was, I'll support your bid for president, you kill Yucca Mountain. And that's exactly what happened. Now the utilities collected $34 billion from ratepayers to pay for Yucca Mountain. The utilities that contributed into that sued the federal government and won, but they didn't get any restitution. Government said that money's already been spent. It was not spent on Yucca Mountain.
I feel like I've gotten in the last 20 minutes an education that should entitle me to an honorary nuclear degree. Well, last question on this for any of the three of you that are best equipped to answer it. And then, John, if you're willing to stick around, I have a few other questions on issues not related to energy, but of issues of common interest to both of us. We're in this era now where cyber attacks have become commonplace. We're seeing government entities subject to ransomware attacks. Are there any measures that you guys are taking that can ensure that the cybersecurity and the resilience of this SMR nuclear infrastructure can withstand potential cyber threats? Anybody?
I think we're at the very early stage of this.
Okay, so then maybe that's premature.
The first nuclear plant, the first SMR, might be installed in 2031.
Ah, okay. So we got a ways to go.
Yeah, we got a ways to go. I mean, this is a project over the next, let's say if the first project is 2031, 7 years from now, it's over the next 7 to 50 years. So it's the, like I said at the beginning, it's the future of America. These are the same reactors that have been in nuclear submarines, let me tell you, 60 years. and they have been safe for 60 years, and they've been operating safely for that period of time. And as one of my friends said, is there any fallout or is there any radiation? Well, we're doing a study to make sure that none of the submariners that worked in nuclear submarines for 60 years ever got got sick or ever got any radiation.
Wow. All right. Happy and Bob, I appreciate the time. I would love to stay in touch with you on this. And I think what you're doing is really interesting and potentially nuclear technology that could make a lot of these different entities that don't seem to agree on anything, make them all happy. Thank you both for coming on.
Thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks for inviting
me. Anytime. John, if you're game for sticking around, I'd love to pick your brain on a few other issues.
I'll be around.
All right. This is The Other Side of Midnight. I'm Frank Morano with John Catsimatidis. We'll continue straight ahead.
The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile. And the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time. There's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
It's The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano.
Jumping little record I want my jockey to play. Roll over Beethoven, I gotta hear it again today. You know my temperature rising, the jukebox blowing a fuse.
Roll over Beethoven by the great Chuck Berry, a classic if ever there was one. This is not just a great song, but it is a birthday bumper music request by Herb Stupp, who in addition to being an Emmy Award-winning TV journalist, was the commissioner of New York City Department of Aging under former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani, our colleague here at the Red Apple Audio Network. There's always an irony when someone that was the commissioner of aging ends up aging themselves. The man who is the grand poobah here at the Red Apple Audio Network, man responsible for not only Rudy Giuliani's radio show, but mine as well, has agreed to stick around with us and chew the fat a bit on a few issues that are in the news. That's John Catsimatidis. In addition to being the owner of this network, he also hosts a very successful nationally syndicated radio program, The Cats Roundtable, and a show that makes more news on a daily basis than any local radio show in America, Cats and Cosby. He's also the author of a terrific book that I mentioned in twice. It's called How Far Do You Want to Go? It's available at on Amazon or at WABCRadioStore.com. John, first let me begin by asking you about the news of the day, and that's this this Trump trial. You had opening arguments on Monday. You heard from the first witness on Monday. I know you've been a friend of the president's for, I guess, about 45, 50 years. You've been a supporter of his in this election, and you've been someone that has said that these prosecutions are totally political. Given your perspective on this, John, what are you expecting over the next few weeks? And do you think Donald Trump has any chance of not getting convicted in this trial?
Well, the truth is that nobody really knows what the jury is going to do. A normal situation, the joke that we were telling right, you know, last week was, who has a better chance, the witches at the Salem witch trials or Donald Trump in Manhattan? So I also criticized, I was on Sid Rosenberg's show this morning, and I also criticized the judge in the case, because the judge is full of hate, and he's not ashamed to say that. And I don't believe the judge, he should be charged with hate crime in a way. I mean, I don't think that President Trump is going to get a fair trial. Now, hopefully the jury has common sense, and hopefully the jury will, you know, just say he's innocent. Because I think the real mission of this judge and the real mission is to keep President Trump tied up in a courtroom for 6 weeks, 8 weeks, so he can't go out there and run his presidency against President Biden. I think that is a sin.
Well, you know,
how can a local judge interfere with a presidential, election?
What's even more egregious in this case, and I brought this up when Judge Mershon was first assigned to the case, but everyone seems to have forgotten about it, is, you know, you've known a lot of judges in New York, so have I. They're prohibited from engaging in political activity, and yet this judge made multiple campaign contributions in 2020 to the person that ran against President Trump. So I don't understand how that doesn't disqualify him from the get-go. And it really, and I wrote a letter to the Office of Court Administration and to the administrative judge, both of which were completely ignored. So it seems like the Office of Court Administration is sort of rewriting their own rules here just for this trial.
Now, I'll tell you another thing. I mean, the Bar Association, where are all the Bar Association? Where is all the high up lawyers? Why isn't anybody speaking out? Now, we're talking about Barr. Let's talk about Bill Barr, the former Attorney General of the United States. Bill Barr does not like Donald Trump. Bill Barr left the administration disliking Donald Trump. Yet, on Sunday, he endorsed Donald Trump. And what was his exact words? It's Donald Trump would make a much better president than the current president.
Yeah.
And he had another few choice words to say about the current administration that I think a current administration is hurting our country in many, many ways, and in the border controls, and attack on our school systems. We're almost on the verge of World War III. And one of my interviews with Mike Pompeo and with Admiral Stavridis, and I said, how many countries have to be involved in warlike situations, right, before you call it a world war?
You know, that's a great question, because and I don't mean to laugh, but the number only seems to be growing. And yeah, the exact words that Bill Barr used was the threat to our country is from the far left, and the drift that's been occurring towards really a socialistic system and one that brooks no opposition. Something tells me, though, that Bill Barr, even if he's voting for Donald Trump, probably won't be on Donald Trump's short list for a Attorney General this time around. We'll see. John, I wanted to ask you about your trip to Las Vegas as well. Before we talk about what you were out there for and the business end of it, how's Las Vegas doing these days? When I was there 3 years ago, they were just starting to reopen. You still had to wear masks in a lot of bars and a lot of casinos. How's it doing these days?
Frank, we haven't been there since last year's broadcasting convention. And in 1 year's time, there were so many new buildings. I mean, Las Vegas is beautiful. The buildings are beautiful, and it's very, very vibrant. The Broadcasting Convention was an international convention. It had 90,000 people. That is a lot of people. And it was busy. The casinos were busy. The stores were busy. The restaurants were busy. The food is great. It has some of the great restaurants in our country. We went one night. We went to Milos, which is in the Venetian Hotel. We stayed at the Wynn Towers, which was a great hotel that Steve Wynn created. Let me tell you something. You know, Steve Wynn got pushed out politics-wise from his own casino, but all the employees there still love him and admire him.
That's great to hear. We have a lot of great listeners, a lot of great new listeners listening to us in Las Vegas right now on KDAWN that really seem to appreciate the show, and a lot of great listeners at the Nevada Talk Radio Network as well. I understand you even played a few hands of blackjack. How'd you do, and is there any sort of method you could let us in on?
Well, you know, I did play blackjack, and I enjoy it. It's because you could sit down and relax and play one hand at a time. And I was playing with Margo, and we played two hands at a time, and we both had a lot of fun. And it's great entertainment, you know. And I did win a few dollars, which is a rare opportunity. Not much, but it was very enjoyable, and the atmosphere was great. You felt a great sense of security. There was security all over the place, and it's a great safe place, and it's a great place to visit. And I told Margo we should go back more often.
Well, that's great. You got to let me know the next trip, because the current mayor, Carolyn Goodman, and her husband, the first man and the former mayor, Oscar Goodman. Oscar's been a guest on the show many times. They keep trying to get us back out there. So I'm glad to hear they're doing well. Did you get to see that new dome at all, John?
Only from afar, and I can't tell you, it's beautiful. Next time I really want to go into it, because I was there for 2.5 days, me and Chad, Margo, Emily, we had Dan Herschel with us, viewing the show. And we also had with us, Kevin, Drosch, they found a lot of new discoveries. There's a big show at the convention center of new discoveries for AM radio and for radio in general. And I had 10 meetings in 10 meetings in 2 days.
Wow.
So we did accomplish a lot. We met with FEMA. We met with the Federal Communications Commission, FCC. FEMA is going to take our site in New Jersey, where our antennas are, and they're going to nuclearize it. See, I can't even say the word.
Something tells me you'd better learn, John. You may have to use that word pretty often these days. John, hang on 1 minute. I know it's late and I'm pushing my luck, but since you mentioned AM radio and some of the meetings you took out there, a lot of folks listening to us right now all over the country, whether they're listening online, whether listening on AM radio, whether listening on FM radio, they're very concerned about the future of AM radio. I want to ask you about that in a minute, because this is something that you've been championing for basically the last 2 years. If you're just tuning in, we're talking with John Catsimatidis. This is The Other Side of Midnight. We'll talk AM radio straight ahead.
The Other Side of Midnight. Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano.
12 minutes to the top of the hour. This is The Other Side of Midnight. I'm Frank Morano, joined for the hour by the man who has made this radio program possible and so many other creative things that are happening on the AM radio dial these days, John Catsimatidis, also the author of a terrific book called How Far Do You Want to Go, which is apparently guaranteed to make you a billionaire. I have not yet become a billionaire, so I have ordered a second copy, and I'm assuming it's the second copy that will put me over the top. John, in all seriousness, you led the charge once these electric car manufacturers, Tesla, Ford, others, announced that they were not going to be putting in AM radio for free as part of that what that was included in their new vehicles. This spurred action on the part of auto manufacturers. Some of them changed their tune. Some state lawmakers have jumped into this. And this is one of the few things in Washington that has become genuinely bipartisan. People that are conservative Republicans like Ted Cruz partnering with folks that are liberal Democrats like Senator Ed Markey. Where do things stand right now, John, in terms of the prospects of congressional legislation to mandate AM radio in every vehicle?
Last week, I had our congressman from South Jersey, Pallone, is it?
Yes, Frank Pallone.
And he made a bipartisan deal. He is the ranking member of the Communications or the Commerce Committee and Energy, and a bipartisan with Congresswoman Rogers from the West Coast. And Congress is supporting it bipartisan. And I think they're up to about, 260 votes, and if Congress itself goes up to 290, there's zero opposition. It just goes forward, and I think they have like 59 senators already, it's look, some of these manufacturers, what they're doing is they're trying to steal more from the public. AM radio has been free forever. If you put it through an electronic system, like in the electric cars, an electronic system, if there is a problem, then you won't be able to get it because the electronic systems will go down. And if there is a problem, AM radio is able to reach the entire country. Everybody with a transistor radio, anybody with a small radio in time of emergency. WABC is one of the largest radio stations in the United States, reaching, I think at night we reach 36 countries on regular AM radio. And all 50 on our stream, and 173 countries, and we stay on the air. And FEMA is going to make sure, no matter what happens, WABC will always be on the air, and you will always be able to communicate. What those electric car companies are trying to do is put it through their electronic system so they can charge every consumer $19.99 a month to be on the air.
And as we've been exposing
something that's free.
If you have to use your phone to connect to their information and entertainment system, they then have your data that they can then sell to data brokers and make money on the back end as well.
Absolutely. And that's their game plan. We are fighting it. The Congress, the Senate has realized that this is wrong. We're part of the national defense system. FEMA has spent a lot of money to make sure we're part of the national defense system. I believe this war will be won, even though some of those companies are still lobbying to kill the bill. And let me tell you something. I went on the air and I said to these companies, I will not allow, our company probably has a few hundred
maybe more. All our companies maybe have 1,000, I don't know, cars. I would make sure that they don't buy any cars that don't have AM radio.
The other thing that I think it's important to keep in mind is that it's not just we're talking about emergencies here, which is what we focused on. There's a lot of content and information that you can hear only on AM radio. And some people may think I'm talking just about conservative talk. And sure, that's part of it. But there's religious programming. There's programming for foreign languages that serves a lot of new immigrant communities that would largely be left out in the cold if these communities weren't able to access AM radio in their cars. So thank you for what you're doing on that. So, John, it sounds like you're pretty optimistic about congressional action on this one.
I'm optimistic. We will fight we will fight. We won't allow AM radio to die. And look, the electric car vehicles are dying. People are realizing that right now the technology is not there. I admired a guy from Toyota, Toyota CEO, which is one of the most successful companies in the world, says, we want to make gas cars. We want to make diesel cars. We want to make what's the other categories?
There was talk of hydrogen for a while, but
No. I'm talking about the regular cars. We want to make gas cars, electric cars. We want to make diesel cars. We want to make hybrid cars. Let the consumer decide.
Well, speaking,
don't let it get forced down our throat by your White House.
Final question, John, and I hope we can do this again because it's been way too long. We spent a lot.
Your ratings are up 20%.
Wonderful. Great. We'll take it. We'll have you on every day. And by the end of the week, we'll be up 100% by that method. It's great. John, we were on the air live when we covered the collapse of the Francis Scott Key Bridge. Right after that, we saw a ship lose power right near the Verrazano Narrows Bridge in Brooklyn. And it sort of raised awareness in people like me, but also a lot of our listeners, that these power failures on ships are more common than I think a lot of people realized. Is this all due to bad fuel, or is there something else afoot here that's causing all these vessels to lose power so frequently?
Well, it's been happening more lately. A, it could be bad fuel because a lot of companies blend their fuel. In other words, they take a gallon of regular fuel, they add some additives to it, and you end up with a gallon, 1.2 gallons. You charge for 1.2 gallons, but you're only really getting a gallon. There are problems like that. But I am worried about infiltration. We had, 5, 6, 7, 8 million people cross our borders. 90% of them are probably good people that want to work, but 10% of them are people that have been let out of jails and mental institutions from the country they come from, because those countries said, why should we take care of you? Go to the United States. They're a bunch of suckers. They'll take care of you. And we end up with a major, major problem. That's why I don't understand President Biden, why he's allowing this to happen. Our country is being invaded. Our country is being attacked with the fentanyl problem. We're creating more drug addicts and killing people. 100,000 people, American people, died in the last 12 months by fentanyl. Now, let me tell you what that 100,000 means. That means like a 727 or 737 going down every day. If 300 people died every day from a 737 crashing, that's 100,000 people. 100,000 people have died from fentanyl.
When you put it that way, that's more people far more people that die in 1 year than died in the entire Vietnam War, at least on the American side. John,
Vietnam, Korea, and Afghanistan all put together.
It is a sad situation. John, we're going to have to end it there. I appreciate you staying up late or getting up early. Please give my best to Margot. Let's do this again soon.
We'll catch up again soon. I look forward to it because I do stay up at night and listen to you. And carry on and get those ratings up. Thank you so much, guys.
I'm trying. Thank you. That's John Catsimatidis. You can catch him on the Cats Roundtable. If you ever can't listen live, you can just go to catsroundtable.com. Hear all the great interviews they do. Speaking of cats, in the words of Bob Barker, help control the pet population. Get your dog or cat spayed or neutered.